Welcome back. Calvin Answers Live, open forum. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin here in the studio with us, and lots of folks on the line, which is very, very nice to see, but means we got to get to our work. You're welcome to call as lines open up. There is one line open up right now. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884. Whether you're Catholic or not, you're very welcome here to ask a question about the Catholic faith. Maybe you want to know something about the Bible. You want to know about Jesus. You want to know about sacraments. You got a moral question, a philosophical question, or maybe, because Jimmy's here, you want to know about dog telepathy, and you just thought you'd pick up the phone and call. That comes up every now and then.
Came up earlier today.
Yeah, we've literally just had a call on dog telepathy, which you might say to yourself, they'll never take a call on dog telepathy. Well, you don't know Jimmy Akin, all right? You clearly don't know Jimmy Akin if you think that. 888-318-7884. Let's go to Kansas. We'll just get right back into this. Let's go to Luke in Kansas, listening on 96.7 FM. Luke, we're glad to have you. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy. Nope, no Luke. I can hear myself, but I can't hear Luke in that line. Okay, I tell you what, Luke, we're not going to abandon you. We'll come back if whatever's amiss gets straightened out. We'll go to Portland, Oregon in the meantime. Dan in Portland, Oregon, listening on Modern Day Radio. It turns out you're next. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin. Hi, Dan.
Hello.
Hi, Dan.
Hi.
You are on the air.
Yeah, Cradle Catholic here. A friend of mine is Cradle Catholic. She has a genius IQ, as a teacher for 30 years. She no longer goes to church. And she says that she's like a big researcher and historical person. So like, I'm trying to find the top two books that will perhaps help define some of these things. That she says that transubstantiation was created by the clergy and authority to control the masses and get them to give more money to the collection. It's just kind of a handmade thing. And then also that the priests are celibate solely because the hierarchy didn't want to pay for wives and children.
Well, I'll let Jimmy take a stab at those two. So she knows the secret history of the Catholic Church, I guess, is the allegation.
But. So both of these are involving judging the motives of another person. And anytime you want to judge the motives of another person, you got a bit of an uphill climb because Jesus said, don't judge other people. Now, he didn't mean don't form an opinion about what you have evidence for based on what someone is doing. You can form opinions based on evidence, but you shouldn't just say, oh, well, someone has done something. It must have been because of a bad motive. Especially, you shouldn't be doing that without evidence. So anytime anyone makes a charge like this to me, I would say, well, okay, so what's your evidence for that? I mean, you can find pundits who are a dime a dozen that will attribute bad motives to people who they have some disagreement with. I mean, turn on any news channel you want, any news channel at all, and you will find people there who are attributing bad motives to people that they have a policy disagreement with. And that's not limited to politics. You know, politics is one of the two subjects they always say don't ask about, that being one and the other being a woman's age. I mean, religion.
I was going to say cannibalism, but all right.
And so you see the same thing in religion, because you have people coming from different religious perspectives, whether they're Catholic or Protestant or Jewish or atheist or whatever perspective they may have, and they look at people with whom they have religious differences, and they say, oh, well, since I'm not a part of that same tribe, they're this other tribe religiously than I am, they must have bad motives that explain why they do what they do. And so you will find these charges made against everybody. They are, like I said, a dime a dozen. And they therefore don't warrant serious consideration unless someone has evidence for them. So where's the evidence? That's my invitation to anybody who makes one of these bad motive charges to explain some historical development. What's your historical evidence? Do you have documents where people who are there saying this is what's happening? Do you have documents from from bishops saying, oh, we need to make sure all our priests are celibate because we don't want to pay for wives and children? Or do you have documents from bishops saying, oh, let's come up with this doctrine of transubstantiation so we can get more money out of people?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have, I don't know anybody who has documents that say things like that. So I would say that this is and I'm not attributing this to your friend, but the people who came up with this charge, I would say, have at best a cynical, non-evidence-based approach to this topic. And at worst, they have a malicious, mean-spirited, and possibly deliberately deceptive attempt or approach to this issue. So I would invite your friend to, if you say she has a genius IQ, that's great. She should be good at critical thinking then. I would invite her to take those critical thinking gifts and apply them to the question of what's the evidence for these beliefs. And I can give you pretty good assurances that there isn't any, because you have belief in the real presence long before you had, whether technically transubstantiation or another version of the real presence, you have belief in the real presence going all the way back. And it was not come up with at a certain point in order to extract money from people. In fact, there's no obvious correlation there between communion, which is one thing you do in church, and the collection plate, because there's lots of things you do in church. And so if she studies the history of belief in the real presence or the history of the Eucharist, she's not going to find that. And similarly, when studying the history of celibacy, well, Jesus kind of was celibate. St. Paul was celibate and recommended it to others, including Timothy, if he's going to be a minister of Christ. So even if celibacy hasn't been mandated for all priests, and it's not mandated today for them in the Eastern Rites, for example, do you think that some priests might say, you know, maybe I should imitate Jesus? Or maybe I should imitate Paul and devote myself wholly to the Lord so I can be a better servant of my Lord and his people rather than encumbering myself with family issues. Because St. Paul talks about that in his letters to the Corinthians. He even recommends staying single even if you're not a priest, if you're an unmarried woman, or if you're an unmarried man and you're comfortable remaining unmarried. He says, hey, you can devote yourself to serving Christ more wholeheartedly that way than if you have a family that you have to devote attention to. And so so saying this is all just a money-based plot is not going to be supported by the evidence. There is actually evidence in the New Testament itself that there are spiritual reasons to pursue this. So I would invite your friend to use her powerful critical thinking skills to investigate these subjects, and I think she'll find that that whatever she's been told about them is not backed up by the evidence.
I'd love to send you a copy of Jimmy's book for you, Dan, of the A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, because you said you'd like a book that helps you answer various questions that come up, and these are 366 of the most common objections or challenges to the Catholic faith that you'll see. So if you want to hang on, I have to go to the break. If you want to hang on, we will be happy to send you A Daily Defense, Jimmy's book. We'll be right back after this.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
I don't like looking back. I prefer to look forward and keep moving forward. There's plenty to cover. I do a lot of research and try to dig out the bits and pieces of a life or an agenda that people don't want to talk about.
The World Over with Raymond Arroyo. Tonight, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Having Answers Live. All right, so we'll try Luke in Kansas again, listening on 96.7 FM. Let me just check real quick. Luke, are you there with us?
Yeah.
Oh, hey, Luke. How are you? Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Good. Thanks for taking my call. I lost it earlier.
It's still a little bit unclear, so I'm just going to ask you to just get right to the question, and Jimmy will give you an answer, because it's hard to hear you, Luke.
Is that better?
Go ahead with the question, Luke.
Hello?
Okay. Luke, what is your question?
Okay, I'm going to come back to Luke. I don't know, is he?
Yeah. So, Luke, when we get you back on, just go straight for the question. Don't worry about anything else. Just ask the question.
Let's go to Ben in Bedford, North Dakota, listening on Two Hearts Radio. Glad to have you, Ben. Go ahead with your question.
Yeah, Belcourt, North Dakota. You betcha. What do you think about that book, Purgatory, by Father F.X. Choupe,
I believe.
I
believe it's pronounced Choupe, though I could be mistaken.
Oh, au français. Okay, cool.
Or German.
So you just want, is there something that you have in particular about that book, or you just want a general review from Jimmy?
Well, I was watching EWTN one time, and the old father there with the long, pointed white beard, he said, I think he said something about he didn't like the book or something.
It's probably
something
Father Groeschel.
So,
oh, maybe Father.
Yeah, there you go. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And I loved the book. I mean, geez, it's just a great book, this Purgatory one, man. But I was thinking, well, what the heck, man? There's something wrong with it, you know?
Well, let's find out. What the heck, man?
So, I'll be happy to answer your question. You betcha. I have the book. I have done a little reading in it. I haven't read the whole thing, although it is on my to-do reading list. And for people who may not be aware, F.X. Choupe was a priest in the 20th century. He wrote a book on purgatory. He wrote another on hell. He wrote some other stuff. And in these books, he relates stories of encounters that people have had, like with souls apparently experiencing purgatory and so forth. So there's some ghost stories in there.
Oh, yeah.
And there are other things. But basically, my impression is that some have been critical of the book of being a little too pessimistic. Or a little too sensationalistic, dwelling a little too much on dramatic, possibly exaggerated encounters, and not exercising enough critical thinking with regard to those, and kind of having an overly negative portrayal of purgatory that could even be frightening for some people.
Okay.
And so I, not having read it myself yet, I don't have an opinion on that. It was written in the earlier part of the 20th century, and I would not be surprised if I found it to have a kind of an angle that would be a little more negative or a little more dramatic than how I would present things. But that doesn't mean I would write it off altogether. And it's a question of anything else of exercising critical thinking. So I plan on reading it. I plan actually on using it as a possible resource for some episodes on Mysterious World. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to, when I do read it thoroughly, I'm going to exercise critical thinking, and I'm going to be aware of other interpretations of purgatory. So I'm not limiting myself to just one theologian's presentation of it.
Yeah.
In particular, I'm going to keep in mind the way the Catechism of the Catholic Church presents the doctrine of purgatory, which is not at all doom and gloom, highly negative.
Yeah.
It has a much more positive presentation of it. So I'm going to keep all that in mind. Also, I'm going to keep in mind Pope Benedict's discussion of purgatory in his 2008 encyclical Salvi on Christian Hope. So I'm going to be aware of these other things, and I'll look at the incidents and the ideas that Father Chappé relates, and I'll give them a thorough consideration. I'm not going to just accept them, and I'm not going to just reject them. I'm going to try to follow St. Paul's dictum of test everything and hold fast to what's good.
Okay, Ben?
Yeah, it's got an imprimatur on there.
The fact it has an imprimatur on it means it doesn't contain heresy. That doesn't mean it's all correct.
Although that's very positive, not to contain heresy.
But
that doesn't mean, right.
The latest, you know, junk science paper probably doesn't contain heresy, but it's by no means correct.
Ben, we have a book on purgatory called Purgatory is for Real. Maybe you'd like to add it to your reading list. If you would, I'd be happy to send it to you, because we can send, as I said earlier, to South Dakota, North Dakota. We just can't send north of North Dakota. So if you want to hang on, Sarah will get your address and we'll send Carla Broussard's book, Purgatory is for Real, for your reading pleasure. I'm going to go now to California. Greg in California, watching on YouTube, got a question for Jimmy.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, Greg.
I had a question about God saying that we shouldn't store up treasures in retirement, and even on the shorter term, people who store up extra food and water for natural disasters.
Okay, so you want to know how those things square?
Yes.
Okay. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is using a mode of speech that was common in his time. It's essentially a form of hyperbole. Hyperbole is exaggeration to make a point. It's very common even today, but it was common in Jewish idiom in the first century, and it's common in the teachings of Jesus. He definitely used hyperbole. And when he says, don't store up treasures on earth, he doesn't mean don't collect the things you need for daily life or for retirement or to weather an emergency. He means don't focus on that to the point that it leads you to lose track of what's really important, what's ultimately important, which is not having treasure on earth, but having treasure in heaven. Because the treasure you have on earth is something you get to enjoy at best for a limited amount of time, but the treasure you have with God in heaven, you get to enjoy forever. And so if you have to choose between the two forms of treasure, it's better to go with the treasure in heaven. But he doesn't literally mean don't save money or don't have supplies on hand for emergencies or things like that. And we know that not only by common sense, but also from other passages in Scripture, where St. Paul, for example, talks about how it's appropriate for parents to lay up treasure for their children, so their children will have something to inherit. But when Jesus is giving these short, pithy sayings, we shouldn't look at these short, pithy sayings as if they express everything that could be said on a topic. They shouldn't be understood as absolutes that you don't need anything else to fill in the other pieces of the picture, because the nature of a short, pithy saying is it expresses something that's memorable, but it's also, in order to be short and memorable, it also is going to be incomplete. And so you need to understand what Jesus is saying in context, which is we need to care more about spiritual wealth than physical wealth. But he's not saying don't do what you need to do to have the resources you need in this life.
Now, that makes sense to you, Greg?
Yeah. Yes, thank you so much.
All right, thank you very, very much. Appreciate that. They were working on the line with Luke and weren't able to get it straight, so we'll get him back. But
well, why don't we answer his question for him, since he spent all that time waiting?
Okay,
his question, his question was, why do we wait until birth to baptize babies? Would it be possible to do a surgery in which you remove a baby from the womb, baptize it, and put it back? And the answer is that the reason we normally wait until birth to baptize a baby is because that's been the only option for most of history. And so that's what people are used to. That's what our culture, that's how our culture looks at this question. But, and secondly, it would be dangerous to do the kind of surgery that he proposes, at least with the current level of technology. However, there have been cases where babies have been baptized in the womb. And that actually goes back at least to the early 20th century, because in the early 20th century, the was then called the Holy Office. Today, it's called the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, actually answered a question on this, where like a bishop had sent them a question and said, can we use, I believe it was mercuric chloride, but it was a disinfectant. And they said, can we use this disinfectant in the water for baptizing children in the womb? When like there's a danger, the pregnancy is going to spontaneously abort and we want to baptize the baby. Can we need to do this in a hygienic way. So can we put a small amount of, I believe it was like mercuric chloride, into the baptismal water to do that? And the answer was yes.
Oh.
And so by the early 20th century, you already had people baptizing babies in wombs. How you would do that is something that I think there's probably more than one option on. You don't necessarily need to do a cesarean in order to do that. I think it would be possible to do it through amniocentesis, where you inject a needle and then you expel the baptismal water forcefully enough through the needle that you are, and you have the end of the needle close enough to the baby that it's definitely making contact with the baby. It's not just diluting in the amniotic fluid.
Wow, how interesting. Well, I'm glad we got to Luke's question. The number here is 888-318-7884, going down to Fort Wayne in Indiana now, watching on YouTube. Taylor, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey there.
Hi, Taylor.
Hey, so I was just calling regarding, I'm actually a Protestant, but we can be on the same page, I think Jimmy and I on this page, and so I think that a believer can fall away from the faith, and that, you know, they can forfeit their salvation via, and so anyways, I want to go into the Hebrews chapter 10, I think, I don't have it in front of me, it's either 28 or 29, but I want to hone in on what Jimmy makes of the term sanctified, because a lot of my Calvinist brothers and sisters try to make that term to either A, to describe the person, that the he in the verse being sanctified is referring actually to Christ, which just doesn't seem like a very intuitive reading of the text. But they, you know, they support it with other scriptures. I think it's like John 17:19 that does say Jesus sanctifies himself, so that others could be sanctified. So anyways, I just was hoping that you could maybe go in depth a little bit there as to what you thought about that verse, namely that the term sanctified and what it's referring to.
Okay, so the term sanctification can have a number of different meanings. It can refer to moral improvement, to moral holiness. It can refer to ritual holiness, even in the absence of moral holiness. Like, for example, the high priests would wear consecrated vestments in the Old Testament, and those vestments had been consecrated or made sacred for, they'd been set apart for the worship of the Lord. And they were therefore sacred or sanctified, even though their vestments, they don't have moral holiness. So the term has a range of meanings. It doesn't always connote moral holiness, but whatever kind of holiness is being applied here, it is something that's significant. Now, the verse in question, the verse that you're thinking of is verse 29, and I happen to have a literal translation in front of me. This is Young's literal translation, but the author of Hebrews is talking about Christians who have abandoned the faith, apostates. And he says, of how much sorer or worse punishment shall he be counted worthy who the Son of God did trample on, meaning he trampled on the Son of God. This apostate person has done that. And the blood of the covenant did count a common thing. Mm-hmm. So he's regarding Christ's blood as, oh, that's nothing. That's just a common thing. In which he was sanctified and to the Spirit of grace did despite. So this apostate is despising the Spirit of grace. The normal way this is taken by scholars is that the he that has been sanctified is the same person under discussion, that it is the person who has counted the body, who has trampled the body of Christ, who has counted the blood of the covenant a common thing, and who has despised the Spirit of grace. It's that same person who was sanctified. But there's more to say. So there's our cliffhanger.
There it is. Okay, if you could, Taylor, just hang on, and we'll come back to you, see if when Jimmy gets his answer done, if it satisfies you. But we got to take a very quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum. Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com. Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Were you able to attend an Advent parish mission this year?
How did it impact you?
We'll talk about that tomorrow on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie on most of these EWTN stations.
Now more of Catholic Answers Live.
Brandon, twice in one day. I love it when you play the groovy music twice. You're all right, Brandon. You're all right. Jimmy Akin, our guest. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. It is Open Forum. We're talking with Taylor in Fort Wayne. And the question has to do with the use of the word sanctifying in the 10th chapter of the letter to the Hebrews.
And specifically the word he.
So maybe just continue where you left off.
Yeah. So, well, we can touch on sanctify a little bit. So the idea of Jesus being sanctified is possible. You can talk about Jesus being sanctified in the sense not that he improved morally, but that he consecrated himself for the service of God.
Okay.
You know, so that makes sense, but it's less natural. Mm-hmm. We don't have lots of references to Jesus being sanctified, whereas we have more references to ordinary people being sanctified. And so that of itself is a sign. But I was going to say, I am aware now, it's been a while since I've looked at the details of this. So I'm going by memory. I would need to refresh my memory on the details of this passage and looking at the Greek and so forth. But There are Calvinists who will attempt to say that when it refers to the blood of the covenant in which he was sanctified, they're talking about Jesus. And so the idea would be that as Jesus is on the cross and he's bleeding and that's his blood of the covenant, Jesus is consecrating himself to God somehow.
So this and person is not the one that was sanctified.
Correct.
Yeah.
That's the interpretation that's offered. Now, my impression is that this is very much a minority view, that it is only advocated by certain Calvinists. And the reason is because otherwise you've got a problem in that from a Calvinist point of view, because they want to say if you've ever come to God and been saved, you will never fall away. Mm-hmm. Because they have a doctrine called perseverance of the saints or preservation of the saints, where God will not let you fall into mortal sin. And so this passage is clearly about someone who's going to experience divine judgment and who has clearly fallen away. And it's even worse if the passage says that that person was sanctified.
That's pretty clear. If it's all that. Right.
And so they want to find a way to say, well, that's not what's happening here, that this person really never was a Christian, and therefore he never really was sanctified mm-hmm. by the blood of the covenant. And so the one option that gets proposed is that the he is Jesus and that Jesus was sanctifying himself on the cross by shedding his blood. Now, that's possible.
Okay.
The question is it what the text is actually saying? And the vast majority of scholars who are not, I think some Calvinists would say this, but the vast majority of scholars, is my understanding, would say that's not what this text is talking about, that the obvious interpretation of the text is that it's the apostate, not Jesus, who was sanctified by the blood of the covenant in this passage. And there are a number of things that would point in that direction. One of them is the language of sanctification, which is more commonly applied to human beings, to ordinary human beings, than to Jesus. Secondly, you've got this sequence of things, and the sequence is all about the apostate, not about Jesus. And you have to jump over a key element of the text in order to get back to a reference to Jesus.
I see. Yeah.
And which is the blood of the covenant. You've got to kind of jump over that to make Jesus the antecedent of the pronoun he. And I'm sure there's more that can be said here, but like I said, it's been a while since I reviewed this, but I think the natural interpretation of the text is that the apostate is the one who was sanctified by the blood of the covenant in this passage. And I think that I agree with the majority of scholars that the idea that it's Jesus who was sanctified by the blood of the covenant here is a strained interpretation.
Taylor, I said I'd come back to you and check with you. All that makes sense to you?
Yep. Nope. That sounds just about right.
All right. Taylor, Jimmy's got a book called The Drama of Salvation, which covers a great deal of what you were talking about, even as you introduced yourself in this conversation. If you'd like a copy of that, I'd be happy to send it to you. You just got to wait on the line, and we'll send you a copy of the Drama of Salvation, the subtitle of which is How God Rescues You from Your Sins. Just hang on. We'll get it to you if you like. I'm going to go now. Oh, the Philippines. All right. We got James in the Philippines back. Nice to have you with us again, watching on YouTube in the Philippines. James, how's the future?
Oh, you beat me to it.
Sorry.
Kumusta, James?
Doing well. Thank you, Jimmy. How do you know Filipino, though?
I know a little bit.
Jimmy Aiken.
Not a lot, but a little bit.
Oh, yeah. He knows everything.
Well, when he gets his new programming, then sometimes new languages will come with it. You know, updates, those kind of things.
It's a gift of the TARDIS.
Oh, TARDIS, all right. Well, go ahead, James, with your Saturday morning question for Jimmy. Oh, no, it's Friday morning right now, not Saturday. Sorry, go ahead.
Yep. So a lot of Catholics would ask one another which saint to pray to when, say, taking an exam or carpentry or farming. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, I guess it's a two-part question. The first, what are the origins of saints being patrons of a specific cause? Mm-hmm. And second, and actually me and my friends were joking about this the other day, say I ask a Blessed Carlo Acutis for faster Wi-Fi because he's apparently the patron of the internet. Is that more effective than asking any other saint?
Okay. So in regard to the first question, in the Christian age, it became, and there's evidence for this even before the Christian age, but in the Christian age, there came to be an awareness that we could ask those in heaven to intercede on our behalf. And as humans, not just angels, started appearing in heaven as a result of the work of Christ, it was natural for Christians to turn to their departed fellow Christians and ask them to pray for them. And so it would be natural to do that. Let's say you're a husband and you've lost your wife. You could ask your wife, who's with Jesus now, to pray for you. And we see evidence of that in a variety of different ways. In the catacombs, for example, there's an inscription that kind of tugs at my heart a little bit. It's for a little girl who lived 2 years and 52 days or something like that. And her name was, if I'm recalling correctly, Matrona Matronata. And in her inscription in the catacombs, it says, you know, basically, here lies Matrona Matronata. She lived 2 years and 52 days or whatever. Pray for your parents.
Oh, gosh, what a beautiful thing.
Yeah. And so it would be, Christians would naturally ask, people in heaven, whether they knew them or whether they were a biblical figure, to pray for them. And over the course of time, it became natural to ask particular people for particular things. For example, let's suppose you live in the city of Milan. And there's a local martyr, someone who you're living in the age of persecutions, and a local person who's Milanese, who's from the city of Milan, was martyred under the persecutions of the Roman emperor. So he's with God now, and you want some help, you want a prayer partner in heaven, and this guy is from your own city. He was martyred right here. He would be a natural guy for you to pray to because he's from Milan. And he would be natural for all the Christians in Milan to pray to and ask for his intercession. And so by that means, he would become a patron of Milan. And also, I wouldn't be at all surprised that Roman culture would have had an effect on this because they had a system of what is known as patronage.
Right.
And in patronage here on earth, you would have a highly placed, influential, usually wealthier person who would serve as your patron, and he would do things for you, you know, to help you out, and you would do things that were nice for him. And the patronage system was how they got things done in Roman society. And so it would be natural for people coming from that culture to say, well, some problems my earthly patron can't help me with. So it'd be natural to look for a heavenly patron. And it could be natural to look for a patron who's like from your city. So he's a patron of your city. Or if he was in the same profession as you, like if you're a tent maker, mm-hmm. maybe you want to turn to St. Paul as a patron of tent makers. Or if you're a physician, maybe you want to turn to St. Luke as a patron of physicians. And so gradually, you know, people would realize these connections that they had with people who would make logical patrons, and they would turn to them. And so the custom developed. In terms of will it help your Wi-Fi be faster if you pray to a particular patron, all I can say is maybe. It's all up to God, whether or compared to some other saint, it's all up to God what prayer requests he grants. So if God intervenes to give you faster Wi-Fi, that's God's choice, and there's no way for me to know, will praying to one saint, will God be moved to help grant that request from one saint more than another saint. What I can say is that God wants us to have heavenly prayer partners, just like he wants us to have prayer partners here on earth. But the details of who would be an appropriate person to pray to on a given prayer request, that's something that we can only take our best guess at and not worry too much about the details, because God hasn't given that to us to know. As long as we're doing our job, trying to live as Christians and be pleasing to God and pray for each other and ask for others' prayers, we're doing what we need to.
Okay, James.
Very helpful. Salamat po, Jimmy.
Ah, salamat po.
Thank you, James. It's always nice to talk with you.
Mabuti.
Yeah, me too. Mabuti.
Yep.
I'm just backpacking on Jimmy's mabuti. And I'm going to take a break so I can ask Jimmy what I just said. All right. Talk to you again, I hope, sometime, James. Right back with more on Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Go forth and preach the good news. It's not just a suggestion. If you want to take more seriously the command of Jesus to share the gospel with those around you, consider joining St. Paul Street Evangelization. It's a grassroots organization that brings the Catholic faith to the streets in a non-confrontational way. Visit our website, www.streetevangelization.com, to learn more. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. It's time to do our part.
EWTN has its own official YouTube channel with tens of thousands of videos covering just about every conceivable topic of interest to Catholics. And best of all, it's free. Every day, EWTN adds new TV shows, live events, devotionals, homilies, and specials to its YouTube channel. Visit the EWTN YouTube channel today. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Catholic Answers Live, Open Forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Got a note here, Jimmy, says you're going to be engaged in a public debate with Bart Ehrman coming
up
in March.
Yeah, how about that? That should be fun.
Yeah. So you'll debate, are the Gospels historically unreliable?
Correct. So he's going to be taking the position that they're unreliable,
yeah,
and I'm going to be debating that.
Ah, and he does, in fact, take the position that the Gospels are unreliable.
Yeah, now that doesn't mean he thinks they're entirely wrong. I mean, he acknowledges that there was a Jesus and he was crucified and things like that. But he, broadly speaking, has a skeptical view of the reliability or historical reliability of the Gospels, and I have a more positive view of that.
Looking forward to it. So it says here it'll be March 24th at 7 p.m. It'll be here in San Diego.
Yes.
And I suppose venue information to follow. But, oh, yeah, because it says more details to come in a few weeks. So stay tuned. But I know lots and lots of people will want to either be present or find some other way to participate. Maybe we'll stream it online. Do you have any idea? Or
I understand plans are in motion for a variety of ways for people to access it. And there's also like a mailing list where you can sign up at Catholic.com and get on a mailing list to find out more details as they're announced.
Oh, this is very exciting. All right. Jimmy Akin debating Bart Ehrman on the topic, are the Gospels historically unreliable? Coming March 24th here in San Diego, we'll give you more details as we have them. I'm going to say Alicia in Oklahoma, watching on YouTube. Did I pronounce it correctly, Alicia?
It's Alicia.
Alicia. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. That was choice B.
It's a common mistake. It's fine.
Okay. Go ahead, Alicia, with your question for Jimmy.
Oh, yes. Thank you for taking my call. I was having a conversation with a fellow Catholic and telling them about how wonderful it is to pray for humility. And the response back was that it's bad for me to pray for humility because by in doing so, I am basically asking God to humble me by bringing about like bad things for my family. So I'm basically like putting my children and my husband and family and friends and stuff in danger, basically, that it's never a good idea to ask God to, especially, I guess, wording it humble me or ask you for humility at all. I know that's not true. Mm-hmm. It's a virtue that we need. Mm-hmm. But I was just wondering how to respond to that.
Well, I would say that that I understand the concern. There can be a concern that people have when they are praying for something of, how is this going to work? Do I really want what I'm asking for?
Uh-huh.
And there can be a kind of temptation to, I don't know if you've ever read the story, The Monkey's Paw, but it's a famous story from the 19th century, and it's about there's a mother and a father and their adult son in the story, and they have this magical artifact from India or somewhere, which is like a mummified monkey's paw. And the thing is, you can use the monkey's paw to make a wish, like three wishes. You get three wishes. And every time they make a wish, they get what they ask for, but it like goes horribly wrong.
Yeah.
You know, so you ask for a bunch of money and your rich uncle dies.
Yeah.
So you can get the money.
Right.
Or you ask for the last wish to be undone and your rich uncle does come back to life as a zombie.
Yeah, it just keeps getting worse with that monkey's paw.
Yeah, exactly. And because God is very powerful, and because God is very mysterious, and because we have fallen human nature, a fallen human nature that leads us to be suspicious and distrustful of God, we can kind of view God as if he's like a monkey's paw.
Yeah.
Where I have to word my prayer exactly right, or it's going to come back to bite me in some way. Well, God is not a monkey's paw. God is not looking to get you or twist your words or say, ha, he didn't technically phrase it this way, so I'm going to teach him a lesson now. That's not how God works. God is a loving father. And so there are qualities that God wants us to have, and humility is one of those qualities. It's viewed very positively in Scripture, and we shouldn't be afraid to ask God to help us grow in the qualities that will be pleasing to him and that will help us and will help others. And humility is one of those. So we shouldn't be afraid to do it. Now, there can be a natural kind of concern or fear of, oh, you know, I don't want to learn this lesson the hard way.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. So just ask God to be gentle. You know, you can just say, God, help me, please help me be humble in the course of my daily life. Or, you know, God, please help me achieve the humility that would be pleasing to you, and please be very gentle with me and with everyone else. And the key thing is, the more important thing is that we pursue the things that will be pleasing to God, even if we're not pursuing them in exactly the perfect way. You know, so I would say the prayer to ask God for what you need, and that's more important than getting scrupulous about have I phrased this prayer exactly the right way.
Alicia, I'm going to leave it there because we're running short of time. I hope that was helpful to you, but I want to get as many as I can on with Jimmy. And up next is Enet in Pennsylvania watching on YouTube. Enet, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Happy
to. My name is Emmett, and I'm a high school senior in Pennsylvania. I'm also a baptized and confirmed Roman Catholic. And today in history class, my teacher and some classmates argued that Christmas actually began as a pagan holiday, and that Christians co-opted a pagan holiday with Christmas. I listened to Catholic Answers a little bit, and I remember hearing about more or less that that's not true. Mm-hmm. My question is, what are the origins of Christmas as a holiday? Did we Christians actually steal a pagan holiday? And last thing, how would I explain this to correct my teacher and classmates maybe tomorrow in class? Also, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, Emmett.
So there are a few things to say here, and I'll try to say them very quickly because we are running short on time. The view that you're talking about is known as the history of religion's view of how we got Christmas. And it was popular in the 19th century, but it has been substantially rejected by historians today because the evidence for it is just not good. And as any time when someone makes a historical claim to you like this, I always invite them to say, show me the money. Where's your evidence? You know, don't just claim stuff. If you right. if you want to say something, especially something that can come across as provocative like this, well, what's your evidence? You know, and let's look at the original historical information, not just what some 19th century guy at the beginning of anthropology may have said. What does the current actual scholarly literature say on this? And the evidence we have now. There is some interesting stuff to say about the timing of Christmas. It's not necessarily Jesus' birthday on December 25th. And there are some interesting ideas about how we arrived at that date. It's likely, it's possible, some would say likely, that it's because this is the winter solstice. And it's 9 months after the after March 25th, which is the Feast of the Annunciation. So if you think Jesus was conceived on March 25th and you fast forward 9 months, you get to December 25th. And that may be related to the fact March 25th was the old way of reckoning the spring equinox, and December 25th was the old way of reckoning the winter solstice. But it's also possible that there's a tradition that was preserved that Jesus was born in this time of year or on that day. We have evidence that the proposed pagan holiday that's involved here, which is the birth of Sol Invictus, the unconquerable sun, actually looks like it was not celebrated by Romans. Number one, it was a very minor holiday, so there's no reason for us to want to co-opt it because it's a minor deal. And it looks like Christians were already celebrating Christmas before Sol Invictus became a holiday. So what I would recommend is that you take a look at a video that recently came out. It's on YouTube. The channel is called Religion for Breakfast. And I believe it was just yesterday. It's been in the last couple of days. The guy who runs Religion for Breakfast, he's a scholar of early Christianity. He's a young guy. He's like a new PhD, but he's a scholar of early Christianity. And he gave what I thought was a very balanced presentation on this, where he looks at the history of religion's interpretation and one of the major alternatives. He's not as comprehensive as I would have liked. There are some things I wish he'd considered or brought up, but he does a really good job pointing out the problems with people who want to confidently claim that Christians co-opted a holiday here. There's just not good evidence for that. And so go to the Religion for Breakfast YouTube channel and check out his most recent videos. And one of them will be on the date of Christmas. And I would say forward that link to your friends and your teacher.
Emmett, what do you think?
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Wait, I got a question for you. I just got a question for you. Is this in a public school? Like in a public school, the teacher got up and said the Christians stole a pagan holiday?
Well, the interesting thing was that the teachers had baptized Roman Catholic too.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, this wasn't a public school, and it really wasn't like the teacher got up there and like wanted to brainwash the kids or anything. It just kind of, you know, came up as like, I don't know, like a casual thing where, you know, like you might just like say like, oh, I read this, and this is actually, no, did you know this? More or less. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, that does make sense.
Also, I believe in the week between Christmas and New Year's, or the week after that, we're going to be having a...
we'll do a podcast.
Catholic Answers Focus podcast on this question. So look for that for more info.
As a matter of fact, I also know, Emmett, that we're going to do an episode of this show after Christmas, and I believe it's the Wednesday after Christmas. It's all Christmas questions with Jimmy Akin. It might be the Tuesday after.
I think it's the...
The Tuesday?
I don't remember what it is.
It's Tuesday or Wednesday after Christmas. It'll be all Christmas questions. So you get all kinds of questions about Christmas, and among them, questions like this that people pose about Christmas. But you're such a sharp guy. I really appreciate your call. I'd love to send you a copy of one of Jimmy's books, and maybe A Daily Defense is the one to send.
Yeah, that would be a good one.
Emmett, if you would like A Daily Defense, and it's okay for us to mail stuff to you if you have, you know, the permission of the adults in the home. I don't know how old you are, so I'm not sure what status is, but we'll send it to you. Just hang on, and Sarah will get your information. Jimmy Akin, another 2 hours.
Hey, how about it?
Done. What do you know? How about it? Yeah, I'm looking forward to recording that. Is
Focus.
Christmas
yeah.
a pagan holiday?
Yeah.
I'm with you. It just seems to come up so much.
Everybody, it does.
And this is one of those things, I guess.
Yeah, well, the 19th century school of comparative religion pumped a lot of junk into our culture.
Right, right, and we're still
cleaning it up.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thanks everybody who called. Again, thank you to you, Jimmy Akin. Tomorrow we've got Gary Machuda is going to be here. I know Gary Machuda is going to be here, and one of my favorites. So we'll see you then, God willing, right here, Catholic Answers Live.